Hello and welcome to a new episode. Dagmar Hovestad is your host today in our series, Can the Records Be Trusted? My guest today is Maria Ristic. She works for Amnesty International in the Crisis Program. So what's the Crisis Program and how do records feature into that?
So thank you, Dagmar, for having me. As you say, Crisis Program can refer to many things, but in the context of Amnesty International, it is a multidisciplinary team that has researchers who travel on the ground and cover certain crises and conflicts. It has experts in satellite imagery, experts in open source imagery, and then communications team, because a lot of our part of our work is advocating for the reports that we are producing and seeking to make some kind of change. So it's around 20 of us. We work together with colleagues across Amnesty, but let's say that our expertise lies in international humanitarian law, international criminal law, and we primarily work to support Amnesty work in different crises and conflicts around the world.
Because Amnesty has a tradition of doing country reports, analyses of conflict, right? So is the crisis program like a progression? Is it a reaction to more information out there, or how did that come about?
So it is, I would say that it is both, but primarily it is focused on providing specific expertise that researchers wouldn't necessarily have, because most of Amnesty researchers work in countries, as you said, and they would report on different countries' issues historically for Amnesty. It could be like rule of law, media freedom, a rise of authoritarianism, attacks on LGBTs, so any human rights issues, very broad. However, when it comes to wars, there is specific violations we are looking into, in particular, violations of international humanitarian law. That is, my colleagues from the law background would for sure give you more details on it, but there is specific types of rules that need to be applied where not every researcher has knowledge, background, and also, as we see last couple of years, the wars seem to never end. So there is also an issue of capacity. We usually have, like, in country one researcher. Sometimes the researcher covers the region, so not even one country. And then when you have conflicts like Ukraine, like Gaza, that seem to be continuing for years, then you need really a big group of people to actually respond, to try to actually respond adequately to the size of violations occurring and then trying to document it.
So you already named two conflicts, Ukraine and Gaza. Were you personally, as an investigator or researcher, involved in any of these conflicts? And what did you do?
So in the context of Ukraine, much more remotely, just because I joined Amnesty when the war was already ongoing. So I worked a bit on crimes related to speech. And then I worked a bit on airstrikes on children. On Gaza, I would say that I work daily. So since October 7, I would, with almost a very big confidence, say that I daily worked on the conflicts related to Gaza, also now Lebanon. So yeah, this was definitely my last year.
And what did you do in terms of records and how do you frame the record? Is it evidence or is it just documentation? What do you look at for the purpose that you want to use it for?
In the case of my work, I would definitely say that that is evidence. And this is how we would refer to it. And we would look into different types of evidence. And the reason why we are gathering evidence is to document human rights violations. So I would say that in my context, evidence comes before documentation. It is definitely part of it. But my primary focus is to gather evidence. And this is where we work like a collaborative team. So we divide roles, different people gather different types of evidence. Obviously, a lot of it, it's still witness testimony. In different contexts, the witness testimony features much more, sometimes features less. And then there's this part of digital evidence, which is primarily my role, that is the evidence we either obtain through social media or that we were given in the digital form by witnesses on the ground, or we acquire through companies who possess certain type of imagery over certain type of conflict.
Like satellite imagery or daylight imagery, that type
exactly.
of data.
That's
And the witness testimony comes in the form of video and photo or even an interview with a researcher on location or with you in Berlin?
Yeah. So the interviews we do, depending on what are we gathering, but we always, because Amnesty is an organization that has tradition, and let's say that we always try to look into the people's voices, so to feature survivors of war. So that is still core of our work. So when I say interviews, this is primarily what we do. And it depends from project to project who does it. We usually try that this part of the work is done by researchers in country where that is possible, because that person knows the people, yeah, knows the context, knows the language as well, which is very important. And then we do either specialized interviews or, where it's necessary, some of my colleagues travel there and support them. But most of my work focuses either on remote interviews, but I would say that that's like maybe 10%. And then everything else is actually some form of digital evidence.
Because access to Gaza for anybody is impossible. And even on the ground, it's very dangerous to make yourself known and talk about stuff, right? So you're pretty much relegated to just looking what comes out on social media.
Absolutely. So I think Gaza in that sense is a very, very unique case. And I always tend to compare it with former Yugoslavia, because this is where I am from. Although I was a relatively young when the war was taking place, but I worked on documentation of war crimes after. So I often compare it with that because it's very close to my heart. But what do we see in Gaza is actually mostly digital evidence. What we see, we try to document. The reason for that, as you have outlined, is primarily access. So we are lucky to have a field worker in Gaza. So we do have a researcher that is there and support us. But he faces the same consequences or the same dire situation as every person in Gaza. So he also tries to survive. So what he can do is sometimes very limited. At the beginning of the war, he was able to document a lot of airstrikes for us. So to interview, for example, survivors, to go at the scene, take photos, because usually on the basis of that, we could have established the weapon and different details around the airstrike, proportionality and different aspects of the violation of the IHL, or like whether there were enough time for evacuation, etc. However, as the war has been progressing, he also moved, as everyone else, in the south of Gaza. So now where he can travel is very limited, both in terms of access. So in some areas, he's not allowed. And where he is allowed, it's often a security issue. So we are very limited by what he can do. So that's why a lot of effort is done on other fronts. So either us interviewing people by phone, or in most of the cases, actually reviewing images, verifying different type of content posted by different people, because we do see a lot of content from Gaza. So that is one of the valuable aspects, that people do use mobile phone there and do record what is happening and then post mostly on social media or send through different channels to different human rights groups.
So I imagine if you do this for a year now, there is a huge amount of data. So when you say evidence, does it have to rise to the level of evidence that works in court? Or is it just evidence to say this actually happened and we keep the record for it?
So I think you made a very, very crucial point here, a very important distinction. So not everything that we see as is evidence. So in the context of Gaza, we see a lot. So there's a lot of content there posted. There's in general a lot of information. However, not all of that is evidence. Only really a limited number of videos posted is a proof of violation. In some situations, like in the context of Gaza, a lot of the content is a violation, and that often is not only posted by Palestinians in Gaza. It's actually very often posted by Israeli military. So we rely a lot in our analysis of the evidence on what has been posted by the IDF, but also by people in Gaza. And then there are two streams of work. One is that we would monitor larger strikes. So for example, if a larger strike occurs, we would anyway gather that document and collect it in our databases. That's one stream of work. And then there is another stream of work that is directly linked with our research question. So depending on our research question, sometimes we would look into whether a strike has been unlawful. Sometimes we would look specifically in the pattern of killings, the patterns of torture, the patterns of forcible displacement. So then depending on what type of crime you are looking as a researcher, then you would search for additional content and then make this distinction between the content that is valuable to you and can serve as evidence. In ideal circumstances, that is what we call primary evidence. But in most of the cases, this is actually supporting evidence. So we combine different types of documentation in order to prove a violation.
Does Amnesty work with court systems, international court systems, to deliver what you recorded, your records, your evidence to proceedings there or investigations?
In the context of Amnesty, collaborating with courts has, I would say, different types of collaboration. It really depends from situation to situation. So we collaborate, for example, a lot with the UN mechanisms. So different types of mechanism, we would provide sometimes written submissions, sometimes we would have meetings, present our evidence, etc. So I would say for the UN mechanisms, that's very straightforward collaboration. We also have like a UN advocacy department, so it's very streamlined. And also UN mechanisms mostly have very similar rules of procedure. So then we are, let's call it, on a very familiar territory, because we as an organization also have obligation towards the people. So the people that we have asked whether they do want to be recorded for our investigation, etc. So there is another level, let's call it, of consent if we would like to provide someone their information for whichever purpose that is. And then on courts, that really depends which court it is. For example, in my specific case, I worked and supported some of the German CSOs in their lawsuits against German government to stop the weapons transfer. So in that case, what we did is we provided to our partner NGO just links, simply because this is how German courts work. They just want your open source content and they will analyze that content by themselves. So they're not so much interested in our analysis of violations. Then some other courts work differently. In UK, we try to do very similar, Belgium as well. And then there are some courts that are international, like ICC, where we don't directly provide evidence. We do meet with them, but we do not provide submissions to them. So I would say that depending really on situation, providing evidence to courts would not necessarily be our mission. It would be like an added value of our work, but we would rather use our evidence to instigate either setting up certain mechanisms for certain conflicts or trying to instigate certain investigations. But we do think that it's up to courts to gather those evidence if they wish to pursue that stream of investigation.
So the records that you collected, be it from open source or even through your closed source or direct investigation, when they go through your process, are they seen as verified Amnesty International evidence or recordings of what happened? Do you have any pushback on that, or do people generally accept the record? Can the Amnesty International record be trusted?
So I would say, from my perspective, that it can be trusted simply because the process of verifying evidence is very rigorous. So what we publish is, in most of the cases, verified. What we understand as verified, because maybe not so many people would know what this word means, or I do think that sometimes this word is also exploited in a way, because verification is a lot of things. In our case, that means that we do know that that content is authentic, that it does represent a certain violation, that it has been recorded in a certain location at a certain time, and that we do know more details about the owner of that content or the uploader of that content. So that's, I would say, ideal scenario. And when that happens, you would see in an Amnesty report, we have verified this number of videos, images, etc. However, in some cases, we don't use that verification standard because the context doesn't allow us that. And that is, for example, in the context of Iran, which we don't today perceive as a conflict area, but it's definitely a crisis area where we also can't access. So very similar like in Gaza. We also don't have a field worker because it's far more dangerous for anyone to be affiliated with Amnesty in Iran because that person would immediately be arrested. And then we rely completely on remote interviews and open source evidence. And in particular, if we look into the example of the protest at the end of 2022, there was an overwhelming amount of visual evidence from Iran. However, because of different issues, including, for example, the fact that Iranian authorities imposed internet shutdown, which means that people couldn't post at certain time when the events were unfolding, so they were able to post a couple of days after. Or in some cases, the protesters were really so scared so that they could record only certain very small segments of the image. We weren't able to verify everything that we are using in our reports, but we were able to authenticate that. So for example, there would be certain types of evidence of a killing of a protester where we would say, this happened in this specific location. We do know who is the protester. However, we do not know, or we have a time frame where we think this happened. So we say our witnesses corroborate this happened on the 13th of November. However, this has been uploaded on the 15th of November. So there is certain, let's say, nuances around what we considered verification, but that really not so much depends on skills of an investigator, but on different context that surrounds certain image and a video that we are working with.
In this context, I also wanted to mention that you are coordinating the Digital Verification Corps. So what exactly is that? And I understand that it also contributes to the gathering of evidence documentation in the Iran crisis.
So Digital Verification Corps is one very beautiful part of my job, and the part of my job that always gives me, I would say, motivation and a real joy to work with, because a lot of the work that I do is very hostile, very graphic content, very disturbing destinies of people. I would say the most horrible crimes that are taking place. But then other part of my role is that I do coordinate the network of universities that work on documentation of human rights violation through digital tools. So it's a network of 8 universities across the globe. So each year we have around 120 students that work with us. So we train them, provide them a training in what we call digital investigations, but that is very similar to what I have been discussing. So how to verify, how to find the content, what are the ethical concerns, what are possibly the consequences in terms of mental health on it, what are the privacy concerns as well. So it's a very, we try to be a comprehensive training that complements the work that they're already doing, because those are students usually in one way or another working on or studying human rights through different disciplines. So sometimes it would be law students, sometimes it would be sociology, anthropology, liberal arts, so quite diverse group. And then they work with us on projects. And then we mentor them along the way. So those are usually very large scale projects where Amnesty can't do it by us only, so by the staff. So then in a way, they are our army of volunteers. Because for people who don't know, Amnesty is also the organization that is mostly based of volunteers. So it's a movement. So before, this is what I like to compare it with. So before, people wrote letters and would come to protest together with Amnesty as volunteers as part of our campaigns. So now this is like the new generation of volunteers. So they don't write letters, but they do verify videos for us. And in some cases, their support is instrumental. Like the Iran project that we worked on, it had in overall like 1,500 videos that we have reviewed. So if I have been doing that alone or together with a colleague, we would probably need very decent, I would say, even a year to do that job properly. And with the help of the DVC, this work has been done in 6 months. So this is, I think, a very, very good example how valuable it is. But it's also, on a very personal note, I think it shows how much young people do want to contribute. Because we often like to judge young people, like, oh, they're not interested, like, oh, that their views on politics are like this and that. They're like this Gen Z versus others. But through this work, you really see how passionate they are, how they believe in the change, and how really they do want to get involved. And what's interesting with this is that they do get involved with the tools that are very familiar to them. So comparing to me, for example, they're much more savvy in many digital tools, do things faster. They think actually through internet because this is their primary way of how they grew up. I was the generation that is split. So I still did the research in, like, now it's called traditional way. And then I took internet as a mean to improve my research standards. While for them, internet is a primary way how they do research.
And the Iran project is also very interesting because there is now a coalition of different NGOs and universities that actually decided to turn the evidence into an archive, right? So we go, the records are collected, and now they become sort of institutionalized, this digital archive, with the purpose of what exactly?
So that's a very good example. And I think it's a good approach in trying to streamline different initiatives, because the documentation on Iran first came from Iran-focused human rights organizations. So they were the one who were posting the content, because people who were in Iran, they were afraid to post with their names because they would be arrested immediately. In many cases, they were arrested just because they were seen on the video. So the way that the content has been published on Iran was through different human rights groups. So they were the first, let's say, people who had the content. And then there were different international organizations who have been gathering that content for documentation purposes. So then with the help of Mnemonic, which is a specialist organization working on archiving digital content, we formed a coalition where all that content will actually be stored in one place and used for different purposes, depending on participating organization. But because Mnemonic is, let's call it, a lead partner or the partner with the most expertise in the area, the purposes of their archives are always accountability. So then the coalition is now exploring different mechanisms where that content can be used. In the case of Amnesty, we very closely collaborate with the UN fact-finding mission. So a lot of our videos went directly to them. A lot of our research feeds into their research reports. But what other members of the coalitions are working more on is trying to do more litigation cases on the basis of universal jurisdiction. So looking for potentially for states where there are certain either Iranian victims or perpetrators of Iranian origin, and then to try to launch those type of cases, I would say trying to mirror similar processes that were taking place for Syria and other conflicts.
Because the country itself is not willing to address any of the violations that it committed.
When I first joined Amnesty, I didn't know how closed Iran is. So I had knowledge of it, obviously, but then I think Iran is definitely one of the countries where accountability is far more difficult than anywhere. And I think what's frustrating there is that the years of impunity are very long. So it's decades of impunity. So now with the fact-finding mission, this is actually like the first more serious attempt to create something that would, in a way, try to be some venue of accountability.
So you mentioned this to come to an end of our conversation. The older ways of dealing with information gathering, more paper-based, and now the new ways. It appears, right, there's such a huge amount of data, and every day there's millions of new photos and videos uploaded. So does it make it easier or harder with this huge amount of data to extract what is needed to document the violations, to keep evidence alive, and also make yourself be heard with what you find?
So that's a very, very interesting question. And I often think about it because, as we discussed, I do come from now we are called traditional researchers. So I did in past, I did interviews and did desk research and sent freedom of information requests. But how I see it and why I decided, for example, in the middle of my career to move more into the, let's call it open source research, is because I see this as one method to do better research. So for me, technology is the way how my research improves. It becomes really strong and better. So that was my primary motivation. Whether it's harder or easier, I think that really depends from situation to situation. And I think this every investigator would relate to that. I mean, even we mentioned former Yugoslavia, even for Srebrenica, we did have photos and images. At that point, there were no social media, but like recordings from the TV reporters were key evidence. So even in the past, we did have photos and images. What is a challenge now is the volume, of course, and finding sources. But I think what is definitely easier today is to incorporate that into your research, because there are different tools that help you to do that, like analyze videos and images, also how you access them. Now that's very fast. Previously, you would probably need to go to that TV station, ask them to give you the specific recording, then you would have to have where to play it, etc. So it was more like sources based on people and whether you have good connections. Now your connections are whom you follow or whether you know how to search the content. But at the end of the day, I think the end result is what is different. And now with this new technology, despite of all the challenges, I do think that research today is much more stronger and maybe faster to do than it was, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago.
Thanks. That's very interesting. The record has gotten stronger and has more depth in a way, right? Even though it's gotten a lot bigger in terms of volume. Thank you, Maria. Thank you for sharing all these interesting, fascinating stories. Thank you.
Thank you, Dagmar, very much.